Today's edition of the Daily Daily Caller podcast is brought to you by Ancient Life Oil.
What is full spectrum CBD? Full spectrum CBD is all the cannabinoids, which in turn gives you major effectiveness. CBD isolate is much less effective than full spectrum CBD. No herbicides, no pesticides, pure organic, non-GMO, full spectrum CBD. Where do you get the good stuff? At ancientlifeoil.com. That's ancientlifeoil.com. Buy CBD tinctures that work. That's ancientlifeoil.com.
Alrighty, hello again, everyone, and welcome to it. It's the Daily Daily Caller podcast, the 28th day of January 2020. Good Lord, it all bleeds together, doesn't it? It's a day that ends in Y. It's a date that ends with a number. So it's a day where liberals are out lying and attacking the president and trying to remove him. So you see, the last 3 years, we really should get a refund on them. Everybody should get to live three more years, just given how the left has tried to, and in many ways ruined, the last 3 years. But we trooper on because we're troopers, and that's what we do. I'm Derek Hunter. I am your host. I am confused most of the time, just the way it is. You can email me, Derek@dailycaller.com. Appreciate those emails coming in. Rate and review on iTunes if you wouldn't mind. I would appreciate that as well. I haven't actually checked in a few days, so I don't know what the numbers are. But they're all thanks to you. You guys rock. And if you'd like to support the show, throw a couple of bucks this way. It's patreon.com/Derek Hunter Podcast. All right, enough housekeeping, enough of this stuff. Let's get into the news. It was the day that the White House defense was able to get going. Saturday was not really a day. I didn't really count that day. It just seemed like they had to check that box because they'd agreed that they would be in session 6 days a week, every day but Sunday. So they had to go in on Saturday, and they did. They did about 2 hours. Yesterday was the day that it really started in earnest, and I thought it was a hell of a show. I actually would love to argue with Alan Dershowitz. I just wouldn't want to have to argue against Alan Dershowitz if money were on the line, because that guy is, you can tell he spent 50 years speaking and lecturing and teaching, and that he knows his stuff. So much so that what the left has done in regards to Alan Dershowitz's statement is largely ignore it. They've really largely ignored it. They can't rebut it. They can disagree with it, but rebutting it is different than disagreeing with it. I don't like it. I don't want to hear it. Fingers in the ear, la la la, is not a rebuttal. A rebuttal is a counter-argument based on fact backed up with research. And there really is nobody on cable news capable of doing that. There just really isn't. They're kind of pathetic, two-dimensional, mile-wide, inch-deep creatures. I really recommend the less cable news you can watch throughout the day and throughout your life, the better off your life will be. Let's just be honest about it from the start. So let's get right to the audio, because I cut up a few clips. Some of them are kind of on the longer side, but I think they're worth listening to because of every chance. Look, anytime you can listen to anybody smarter than you say anything, you should listen to them. Whether you like what they have to say or you agree with what they have to say is irrelevant. How they say it, you can learn a lot from, and the manner of persuasion. It is, sadly, most of the time, how you present things that matter much more than what you present, particularly if you're in some sort of debate society or something. I never did debate. I never studied law, although a lot of ex-girlfriends have said that I argue like a lawyer. What are you going to do? Just so happens that I happen to have a good memory. I'm lucky with that. But you, even if I didn't like somebody, even if I disagreed vehemently with someone, you can still learn from them, even if it's just tactical. And tactics are very, very important. So even if you don't like Alan Dershowitz, listening to how he formulates an argument, how he puts it together, how he presents it, not only in how he speaks, but in revealing of how he thinks, is wildly important, I think, to everybody. So, yes, Adam Schiff sits up there and he drones on, and every once in a while he raises his voice, and then he goes back down to being calm, and that gets boring after a while, particularly when you're repeating the same thing over and over and over. I would like to point out that Republicans did not do what Democrats did, have a couple of points and hammer them home over and over and over again. It's the old, a lie becomes the truth if you repeat it often enough axiom. That's what the Democrats were employing. Of course, they were doing it not because they were going to try to convince anybody in the room. They were doing it because they were trying to play to the audience back home. The defense team is out there making a case, and they're making the case to the senators in the room, which is important, which because they're the ones that get the vote. I also think that we're looking at a schedule where we're going to get to the 16 hours of questions starting probably on Wednesday, which I think will be the really interesting part. Hello, Quinn. You're wearing your crown. Are you a princess?
Oh, where's my magic? I got my purple dress go.
Where's your magic wand?
Oh, you know, it's going to go upstairs.
Yes, your magic wand is upstairs, but you're just going to have... You're magic. You don't need a wand.
Where's my purple dress? Where's the Michael?
You're always very... you're like a Democrat. You're better not grow up to be a Democrat, but you're worried about what you don't have. Instead of enjoying what you do have. Go along and play. Daddy's about to play audio from an impeachment trial, so don't get jealous while you're out there. I'm sure she's torn up. She's sitting in the other room going, man, I want to play audio from the impeachment trial. You get to have all the fun. But first, before we get to the Alan Dershowitz stuff, a word from our sponsor, AncientLifeOil.com. AncientLifeOil.com is your place to get CBD oil, the best CBD oil around, to be perfectly honest with you. 100% organic. There's no THC. You're not going to get high. It's like 0.003% THC. You couldn't get high off of it if you wanted to, but what you will get is relief off of it, relief of stress, relief of little bitsy pains around your body, those annoying little ticks. And oh man, my knee's bugging me today. Now try AncientLifeOil.com. You put some of that under your tongue and you'll be surprised how quickly it impacts you. You can also do the topical cream if you don't feel like trying to, if you're a little uncomfortable or you think the idea of putting oil under your tongue, because like I've gone to those olive oil shops and you try the oil and you're like, ooh, the garlic oil, this is good. And then a couple of shot glasses into oil of trying different flavors, you just start to feel like you're going to get sick. You don't take that much of the CBD oil that ever is going to be a problem, but I could see how somebody could be turned off by it. Go to AncientLifeOil.com. Check out your selections there. You get to choose your flavor. You get to choose your strength. You get to choose whatever you want. And then at checkout, enter promo code Derek, D-E-R-E-K. Click the apply button and boom, great savings right in your pocket, saving you money, making you feel better. You can't beat it. Trust me, I do it every day. I use CBD oil every day, and it really has made a huge, huge difference. AncientLifeOil.com, promo code Derek. Quinn is back. What's up, Quinn?
I'm got a pink phone, got a pink phone.
Yeah, you've got a pink pillow cell phone and a pink crown on because you're a princess, and you got pink pajamas on because it's your bedtime. Are you tired and ready to go to bed?
No, I'm waking up.
All right. Go wake up and play and try and keep it down. Everybody else is sleeping. Okay, she's the most popular part of the show. I could say anything and nobody gives a damn. But as soon as she comes on, the emails come in. Oh, she's so cute. She's so cute. She is. She really is. But hurts my psyche a little bit that she's wildly popular and I am not. I want to give a shout out to Karen. She's up in Pennsylvania. She's going to a Trump rally, and she has printed up, and she sent me, she's printed up little business cards for the podcast that she's going to hand out at the Trump rally. She's going to see my buddy Chris DeGaulle up there too, who's a great guy. So thank you for that, Karen. You're awesome. That's what I'm talking about when I say you guys are doing things, promoting this show. You're better at promoting this show than I am, because I feel weird talking to anybody about it. But you guys are super cool. So thank you. Thank you for that. All right, let's get to the Dershowitz, the Dersh audio. Man, the Dersh. I really want to get him back on the show. Which Dersh cut do we start with? Let's start with him blasting Maxine Waters and the Democrats on this impeachment garbage, but in particular Maxine Waters, because essentially what the Democrats are arguing is, and they have been for a long time, that unambiguously, you can impeach a president for literally anything, that there are no standards whatsoever. I don't like the cut of his jib. So Article 1 of impeachment is having a bad jib. And that's an argument that the left has made about impeachment, is if the House, if 215 members of the House deem that it having a bad jib is impeachable, well, then it's impeachable. What are you going to do about it? That's just the way the founding fathers laid it out. There are some guideposts. They didn't put, you know, guardrails on it, but there are some guideposts up there that are supposed to let members of Congress know where to go and how far to go. The founding fathers, you see, in the Federalist Papers, they did argue that it could get out of control, that it could, because there was going to be no real guidelines as to what would constitute the removal of the president of the United States. And they had an inflated sense of themselves, you could argue. Because when you're setting up the government and you look at the situation, you look at the men around you who are all brilliant and amazing people and came up with one hell of a system of government, you sort of begin, you could be easily lured into a complacent sense of history, future history, that always people like that would be the ones elected, would be the ones with their hands on the levers of power. So it was sort of that laissez-faire, look, we don't really have to worry about setting out strict guidelines for impeachment because no Congress full of the best and brightest citizen legislators that the country has to offer would ever abuse this, right? There's that sort of appealing to, not even appealing, but sort of a naivete about the better nature of humans based upon your surroundings. If you are only ever surrounded in your life by really good people and then you go to New York one day, you're completely freaked out. You're like, what the hell is going on? What happened to everybody? Everybody I knew was great and I didn't know that bad people existed, and now I'm in New York and it's awful. It was that kind of mentality. You could understand back in, you know, 1789, 1787, there was this sort of, it was a very small world, the people who were interested in politics. It was a very small country. So there really, everybody was kind of on the same page, definitely at least in the same book. Nowadays, we're working on different books. The left is running around working on coloring books. So you could forgive them for thinking, look, we don't need to lay out these very strict guidelines about what would constitute a removable offense. We'll just say treason, bribery, and other high crimes and misdemeanors. And everybody kind of in good faith will act in good faith. There is no way on God's green earth the founding fathers could have envisioned what the Democratic Party has become. How polluted and perverted to the concept of justice and reality the Democratic Party has become. So they couldn't really guard against it. They couldn't. You can't fathom that. You can't fathom these people who want to impeach the president for existing wrong and just set out to find and manufacture anything possible to get rid of them. Even at their worst, when they were out dueling, they weren't out trying to violate the Constitution of the United States. So they didn't set out these strict guidelines of what constitutes impeachment, but they did lay out a pretty good path, a couple of arrows here and there, this way, not that way. And, you know, when you say this way, implicit is not that way. And Alan Dershowitz laid out that case very succinctly. But in doing so, he blasted Democrats for the mentality that, hey, you can do whatever, we can do whatever we want. We're the House of Representatives. What we say goes. And for what Dershowitz says here is very much like what Democrats are always. Democrats are accusing Donald Trump of doing. He's a dictator. You heard Jerry Nadler say that yesterday on the show. Donald Trump has become a dictator. He is awful and dangerous and a dictator. It's the House of Representatives who are acting like lawless dictators. Here's Alan Dershowitz basically making that case.
Congresswoman Maxine Waters recently put it more succinctly in the context of a presidential impeachment. Here's what she said. Impeachment is whatever Congress says it is. There is no law. But this lawless view would place Congress above the law. It would place Congress above the Constitution. For Congress to ignore the specific words of the Constitution itself and substitute its own judgments would be for Congress to do what it is accusing the president of doing. And no one is above the law, not the president and not Congress.
By arguing without limitation, as Maxine Waters did, and what Dershowitz points out there, that impeachment is whatever Congress says it is really game on. It really is game. It is nonstop impeachapalooza. Every time the House of Representatives is controlled by the other party than the White House, it's impeachment time. That would, as he said, put the legislative branch above the executive branch. There would be no recourse for the executive branch. The executive branch can't impeach Congress. But the executive branch isn't supposed to be impeached by Congress, except in extraordinary circumstances. Democrats have dumbed that down. If this succeeds, or if this even drags on, to be perfectly honest with you, and works, if in 2020 Donald Trump loses even a close election, especially a close election, then it's game on. Then what's, well, it was an impeachment. It was an election tactic, and it worked. Remember when Harry Reid was in the Senate, and Harry Reid went down to the floor of the Senate in 2012, and I don't think Mitt Romney's smart enough to connect these dots, but it's essentially what they're doing with impeachment. Harry Reid goes down to the floor of the Senate and says, well, word is out. I'm told that Mitt Romney hasn't paid any taxes for 10 years. He flat out lied, and then he was asked about it, and he said, well, let him prove he hasn't. Let him prove he has paid taxes. I mean, Romney had released his taxes already. It was absurd. It was a lie, but it stuck. The media, rather than go after Harry Reid and demand where he'd heard these ridiculous stories that Mitt Romney was a tax cheat, they ran to Mitt Romney and said, are you a tax cheat? Harry Reid says you're a tax cheat. Are you a tax cheat? No, I didn't. I paid my taxes. No. You prove that you're not a tax cheat, which, of course, is impossible to do. Then after the election, after Mitt Romney lost and after Harry Reid retired, he should have been retired, but he retired instead. He was asked in an interview, like, you lied about that. And Harry Reid's answer was, well, he didn't win, did he? They didn't give a damn. Harry Reid and the Democrats, there was no Democratic Party condemnation of Harry Reid going to the floor of the Senate and lying about Mitt Romney and his taxes. There wasn't. They were all thankful. Oh, yeah, hell, that worked. That worked great. Doesn't matter. So the lesson was, if you can get away with it and it works, why not do it? Republicans didn't seem to learn this lesson, but Democrats already knew this lesson, and they're sticking to it. So you impeach the president, and it might work. God knows, electing or nominating one of the weirdo Democratic candidate socialists that they have running over there isn't likely to work, certainly not on its own. But if you can't prop up your own candidate, you've got to knock down your opponent. And what better way to knock down an opponent than the ultimate way to knock down an opponent? And that is label them with a scarlet eye. They are an impeached president. And you can't reelect a president who's been impeached My God, everybody knows that presidents being impeached means that they are wildly corrupt. You see how it works? They don't give a damn. They don't really. They know that he's not going to be removed from office. They need to drag this out and try to damage the president's reelection campaign, because this is their election strategy. Damage Donald Trump. Because honestly, what are the Democrats offering that are going to have non-socialistic, non-sucker, non-desperately looking to the government to take care of them loser liberals? What are they going to do beyond them? You got to appeal beyond them. Well, you can't. They've attracted, look, piles of crap attract flies. They don't attract butterflies. Well, you can't win an election with just flies. You've got to find something else to attract, even if by attract you really are trying to repel from the other side. And that's what impeachment is. They're trying to repel voters from the other side. When this is all over and done with, I guarantee you one of the things that the Democrats are going to be hammering from an electoral standpoint is going to be along the lines of, we need to get rid of Donald Trump because he's so divisive in this country. He's driving us apart. They kind of do it. They're trying to say that Donald Trump's strategy is to drive people apart, but Donald Trump's strategy is not to drive people apart. That's a ridiculous thing. That's the left that drives people apart. How much do you make? What color are you? What gender are you? What gender do you prefer to sleep with? So on and so forth. Get into your little Tupperware container, your Ziploc bag, and stay in your little lane there. Do not stray from it. That is driving people apart. Donald Trump doesn't give a damn about that kind of stuff. In many ways, on social issues, he is by far the most progressive candidate out there because he doesn't give a damn. He's a genuine progressive, whereas in the sense that Democrats try to use the term, in that he doesn't give a damn. The other side cares very deeply and wildly and judges people based on it. That is not how they use, that's actually what progressive is, but it's not how they use the term. They're actually engaged in bigotry. They will judge somebody for all of those characteristics that have nothing to do with who that person is as an individual. It's kind of hilarious and sad watching. It's hilarious watching them do it and sad that it works on so many of our fellow Americans. But if this is allowed to stand, if this is even allowed to drag out, if this succeeds, and I suspect even if it doesn't succeed, but it comes close to succeeding, this really is going to become the new norm. You are my political opponent. I don't want to battle you on the battlefield of ideas. I'll just try to destroy you. That's all we have. I will destroy you, and I don't care what I have to do it. I'll lie about you, as in the case with Romney, or I'll impeach you. If you beat me fair and square in an election, I will impeach you. I fear if the Senate does not act like the adults in the room, if they are not the saucer that cools the tea, as they are supposed to be and very proud of saying, that this country will be fundamentally transformed forever now, because you really can't put that toothpaste back in the tube once you squeeze it out. And if somebody doesn't step up and say no more, it's sure as hell not going to be the Democrats. Then nobody's going to step up and say no anymore. All right, more Dersh. Let's get some more. You got to have more Dersh in your life. Talk about, he went on for a long time, and it was the only presentation on both sides that I watched all of. I was cooking at the time, but I was streaming it on my phone. That's how big of a nerd I was. I wanted to see the whole thing. And he went off about the concept of Article 1 of the impeachment powers. And I've talked about this at length, but he does it much better than I do. The idea of the abuse of power as an impeachable offense, and something as any kind of standard. It's not a crime. It is a tactic. It's not a crime. It's a tactic. And Dershowitz points out that it's a standardless standard. It can mean anything. If this is allowed to pass, if this is allowed to stand unchallenged, if the Senate lets this go, if the Senate embraces what the House has done here, even by prolonging this ridiculous trial, then they're setting a standard that is standardless and that there will be horrible repercussions in the future for. Here's Dershowitz making that case much more eloquently than I just did.
Words like abuse of power and obstruction of Congress are standardless. It's impossible to put standards into words like that. Both are subjective matters of degree and amenable to varying partisan interpretations. It's impossible to know in advance whether a given action will subsequently be deemed to be on one side or the other of the line. Indeed, the same action with the same state of mind can be deemed abusive or obstructive when done by one person, but not when done by another. That is the essence of what the rule of law is not. When you have a criteria that can be applied to one person in one way and another person in another way, and they both fit within the terms abuse of power.
Again, I told you, the guy is brilliant, and he did his homework. You can see why he was a law professor and the preeminent law professor in the country for 50 years. And the ease with which he spoke, and the confidence, and the... I don't know. It was just everything about it. You can tell he's comfortable being in front of a crowd because he's probably given speeches in front of thousands of people before. I'd be up there hiding behind the microphone, mumbling to myself, going blah, 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 blah. But he was up there and he made a hell of a case. And it really is. These are meaningless. Meaningless. These are points that I have made before. That's not only why I agree with Dershowitz, but it's part of why I agree with Dershowitz. Obstruction of Congress has never been, nobody's ever been charged of anything obstruction of Congress. Find me somebody who was accused of obstruction of Congress. They always say, well, you know, it was Article 4 or whatever in the Nixon impeachment. So that just that they didn't get around to actually impeaching Nixon doesn't really matter. It does matter. It matters dramatically. Historically, Richard Nixon was not impeached. He was going to be impeached, but he was not impeached. And when talking about history, it's important to be accurate. Because if you're people who are inaccurate about history are doing so for specific reasons, generally political and personal reasons. But that Nixon, that the House back in 1974 had drafted up an article of impeachment called Obstruction of Congress, is irrelevant. To say that that is somehow precedent setting is to say that the Congress is infallible, and simply because they drafted some people back in 1972 amongst a whole bunch of articles of impeachment, that they drafted one that was obstruction of Congress, therefore it's a real thing, is ridiculous and a childish argument. And it really, it's used so they don't really have to try and justify the weakness of the argument. They can just, well, somebody's done it before. Somebody's done it before. Remember, Democrats could have impeached Donald Trump on any number of the things that they accused him of. And Lord knows they accused him of every crime under the sun short of murder. I don't know that any of them accused him of murder. It wouldn't surprise me. But short of murder, they had accused him of everything. Treason, bribery, extortion. All you imagine it, what it was, anything that they had said at some point, they had accused Donald Trump of all of these things, all of these crimes. They chose not to impeach him on any of those things. Why? Again, it's a case that I have made repeatedly, because if they accused him in an article of impeachment of bribery, we know what bribery is. The public knows what bribery is. We also would need to, you know, be able to discern, show us the evidence of bribery. We know what that is. And then they wouldn't be able to produce it because there is no evidence of bribery, even though they had all gone to microphones and accused him of it. And in the congressional record, they've all accused him of it. They chose not to charge him with it because, again, they couldn't prove it. They couldn't come anywhere close to proving it because he didn't do anything close to it. So they had to scrap that. And it was the same way with extortion. It was the same way with everything that they floated. Every idea that they've tossed out there, we have that is a real crime, we know he didn't do because we understand what constitutes proof and evidence in those cases. So they had to create them at whole cloth. Well, what obstruction of Congress doesn't exist. So then what constitutes proof of obstruction of Congress? Well, they get to say what it is. They just get to make it up. They're creating their own standards. Abuse of power is meaningless. It's a tactic, not a crime. But if you make it, that tactic, a crime, then you get to decide what constitutes proof of that crime. That's what they tried to sneak through. That's what they tried to justify. This is a semantical impeachment more than anything else. And what Dershowitz and the rest of the Trump defense team yesterday did was blow that concept out of the water. They took it from the theoretical semantical arguments and tore it apart in reality with reality. Now Dershowitz, we got one more Dersh, and then we'll move on to other people. Dersh went after, because the big story yesterday, and I haven't spent time on this yesterday or the day or today, the John Bolton, latest John Bolton revelations. Oh, his book says this, his book says that, his book says the other thing. It's being reported that his book says these things by people who have not seen the book. So again, we're dealing with a game of telephone. Remember what we heard about the whistleblower complaint? Remember that? My God, the call was so horrifying and disturbing that they had to go and file this whistleblower complaint. They were so disturbed and upset by what they had heard on this phone call. Then it found out, well, they hadn't actually heard the phone call. Oh, and we got the transcript, and there was nothing remotely close to what they were saying was on this phone call, But we're going to plow ahead anyway, because this was their game plan all along. I suspect it could be something like that with Bolton's alleged book. If Bolton has something to say, there is nothing stopping Bolton from saying it. Literally nothing stopping Bolton from saying it. Except that he won't sell as many books as if he comes out and says it. So he's hoping to, if he fills in the details, he won't sell as many books. So he needs to keep it nebulous. He needs to keep it secondhand. And all of these stories about John Bolton's book, John Bolton alleges in his new book that X, Y, or Z, there are no quotations from the book. Why? Because none of the reporters who are reporting on it have seen the book. They don't even really know, I would assume, if the person, unless it's from Team Bolton themselves, and they've all denied it, and they wouldn't lie, would they? Publicists don't lie, do they? Unless it's coming from Bolton's team, there's really no way for anybody to have seen this book, unless it's coming from Alexander Vindsman's brother, Yevgeny. That'll be interesting. See if we can find that out. But Dershowitz addressed that. Yesterday, addressed the so-called Bolton revelations, and I suspect there will be more every single day because the New York Times is involved in this, and they are coordinating with somebody to try to get witnesses in this hearing. They want to prolong this. They really think that if they just keep making the argument long enough, the American people will start to care. I don't believe that's the case, but that's their case because the alternative they would have to offer, you know, a legitimate legal case, and they don't have one because they haven't alleged any crimes. So Dersh addressed this and basically talking about how even if the worst interpretation of what the interpretation of the secondhand interpretation of the third hand information about what's allegedly in John Bolton's book were true, it's still not impeachable.
The claim that foreign policy decisions can be deemed abuses of power based on subjective opinions about mixed or sole motives, that the president was interested only in helping himself, demonstrate the dangers of employing the vague, subjective, and politically malleable phrase abuse of power as a constitutionally permissible criteria for the removal of a president. Now, it follows from this that if a president, any president, were to have done what the Times reported about the content of the Bolton manuscript, that would not constitute an impeachable offense. Let me repeat, nothing in the Bolton revelations, even if true, would rise to the level of an abuse of power or an impeachable offense. That is clear from the history, that is clear from the language of the Constitution. You cannot turn conduct that is not impeachable into impeachable conduct simply by using words like quid pro quo and personal benefit. It is inconceivable that the framers would have intended so politically loaded and promiscuously deployed a term as abuse of power to be weaponized as a tool of impeachment. It is precisely the kind of vague, open-ended, and subjective term that the framers feared and rejected.
A freaking men. Where we set the standards now, it will have ramifications for the rest of our lives and the lives of our children and our children's children and so on. Do we want to set the bar low or do we want to set the bar high? It used to be a matter of trust. Now, unfortunately, the people entrusted have proven themselves to be untrustworthy. It's really, really kind of sad. What's also sad is how the media has taken an adversarial role. I want to play this clip of Congresswoman Elise Stefanik of New York. She was one of the stars of the House impeachment trial, Republican. She's on the advisory team, the president's advisory team when it comes to impeachment in the Senate. And they have been doing press conferences, as everybody has been doing press conferences. And I want you to note, even more so than what she says, although what she says is pretty important and telling. But I want you to note the tone and the tenor of this. It's a confrontation with reporters. And think back to all of the Democratic press conferences that you've heard and seen clips from to this point, be they featuring Adam Schiff and his gang of people, or if it's Chuck Schumer and his gang in the Senate gallery, or any Democrat in the hallway, any Democrat anywhere. And think about the way that those Democrats are spoken to and the way that you hear Republicans spoken to. There's a real debate. There's an argument. It is an argument between Republicans and reporters. They have taken sides. It is simple, basic questions when it comes to a Democrat. Well, do you think that you're, and the questions are usually, do you think Republicans are going to come around on witnesses? Like, I'm not really sure what kind of a question that is, but that's the quality level of questions that Democrats are asked. Republicans are debated with. Whoever this reporter is in this shot, you can only see her from the side and the back, and it's not somebody I recognize. She is waving her finger at the Republicans, and Elise Stefanik steps forward, so she's waving her finger at Elise Stefanik. She's arguing. She is taking an adversarial role, which, from a practical standpoint and a journalistic standpoint, I have no problem with if they took that same adversarial role with Democrats. They don't. They take a fawning sort of stenographer, please tell me what to think, Pappy, kind of role when it comes to Democrats. When it comes to Republicans, it is, why don't you support this? Why are you trying to block? Are you going to continue to try and block this? Are you going to try and continue to try and block that? That sort of mentality. So here is Elise Stefanik. She handles this woman. She smacks her six ways from Sunday, but it's very telling, and I want to play this mostly for the tone between the congresswoman and the reporter, and see if you've heard anything remotely close when it comes to a Democrat taking questions.
The president did tie this security assistance to pressure Ukraine to investigate Biden. That's okay.
He did not, because the aid was released to Ukraine and there was no investigation. And the president has said that he did not tie. There was no conditionality. Gordon Sondland, in fact, testified, and we saw that played out as the president's defense team made the case that it was presumption, assumption, and guesswork. So the facts of this case remain the same in that we have more security assistance for Ukraine, much more than during the Obama administration, and there was, in fact, no investigation into the Bidens.
But
and the administration, Adam Schiff's choice. Adam Schiff is clearly scared that his case is so weak. Adam Schiff made the decision to withdraw the subpoena. This is an unfair, unconstitutional, and half-baked set of impeachment articles that was sent over to the Senate.
Have you heard anything remotely close to that in the interactions with Democrats in the media? I bet you haven't. I haven't. I hope to God I'm watching more often than you are, because, God, I if I'm watching this and everybody's watching this, then nobody's having any fun, you know? But I haven't heard anything remotely close to that. It's weird. The confrontation, the tone, the disagreement, the obvious agenda coming from these so-called journalists out there going, why don't you just do this? Why not? There's no Democrat. There's nobody chasing down a red state Democratic senator saying, are you coming around? Have you changed your mind on the idea of witnesses or not? Do you think that there shouldn't be witnesses? Haven't you seen enough, Senator? Haven't you seen enough to say that there's no need for witnesses? That question hasn't been asked. Another confrontation that happened with reporters was with Ted Cruz. Again, the reporter is off camera. I don't know who it is. They deserve the whatever scorn can possibly come their way, because it's a disgusting display of anything but journalism. But it's worth noting that they're basically trying to defend Hunter Biden by attacking everybody else's kids, saying, well, you know, half the kids in the country, half the kids of members of Congress, and they all do it. Why are you going to single out poor, sweet, nourishing Hunter Biden? Maybe all the kids should be in jail. And Ted Cruz has sort of a lighthearted comeback, but then the reporter is not having anything to do with lightheartedness, because liberals are joyless creatures, and then it intensifies a little bit. Listen to this exchange.
Basically, what they said was Hunter Biden got a job. If that was vice president, if that's a crime, I mean, shouldn't half of your children be in prison?
My children are 9 and 11, and I'm sorry that you want to throw a 9-year-old in prison. Wow. But at this point, my third grader plays basketball and softball at her school. So stop playing the nasty. No, stop playing the nasty Washington game.
I'm sorry, that's not nasty Washington game.
Sorry. Attacking a 9-year-old?
Senator, we've seen.
And then they moved on. But I'd like to note that the reporter is basically saying, what Hunter Biden did is no big deal. Everybody does it. Okay, yeah, you're right. A lot of people do that in Washington. It's something I've talked about here. It's something I've written about a lot. How the new corruption actually works in this country. It's not bags full of cash. It is, second, we're going to hire your wife. We're going to hire your husband. We're going to hire your kids. We're going to take care of your family by proxy. All you've got to do is vote for stuff that we want, support stuff that we want, and we'll take care of yours. There's no dots to connect. It's just a horrible, wild coincidence. Oh, yes, Hunter Biden, completely unqualified, within a couple of weeks of having been kicked out of the Navy for testing positive for cocaine, he lands a gig more than $1 million a year with Burisma. He's making personally between $50,000 and $83,000 a month. His firm's getting $1 million. And there's nothing shady going on there. It just his father is spearheading, is in charge of all of U.S. policy regarding the country. But there's nothing sketchy going on there. We've been told that what Hunter Biden did, there's not even a hint of scandal. There's not even a hint of anything possibly wrong with that. Why, none other than Chuck Todd and pretty much every anchor, Jake Tapper, when asking questions. There is no evidence whatsoever to suggest that what Hunter Biden and Joe Biden did was any kind of unseemly at all. But Republicans are persisting on attacking these poor, sweet, innocent people. And then it's come around to now everybody does it. Well, I don't see what the problem is. Everybody. Well, if everybody does it, does that make it right? Does that make it cool? just because the people who write the rules that they have to live by carved out these nice little niches for themselves so that their families can get incredibly wealthy while they're, you know, suckling the teat of government power and taking care of their patrons? Does that make it okay? Does it being legal make it okay? Because what Donald Trump did is legal. Most Democrats will admit that. What Donald Trump is accused of doing in the articles of impeachment is legal, or at least not illegal, but they're saying that it is so egregious anyway and so awful anyway that he deserves to be removed from office because of it. So they didn't charge him with a crime, so therefore, by process of elimination, they're saying it was legal, but he needs to be punished for it anyway. And now they're saying, well, what Hunter Biden did, everybody did, so I don't see what the problem is here. Should your kids be in jail? Well, my kids are 9 and 11. What do you want to throw them in? They didn't do anything. I don't know what the hell you're talking about. This is what happens when you try and rationalize the behavior that you can't really rationalize. When you try and rationalize bad behavior in bad faith, when you argue in bad faith, you come up with arguments like that reporter had. Not that they care. They're not held responsible for anything. That reporter, I don't know who it is. They'll probably likely not be identified, but it's telling. And it's telling in more ways than one, not just in the words, but that it really could have been just about any damn reporter up on Capitol Hill. It could have been any of them. It doesn't. If I told you that reporter worked for CNN, you'd go, oh, yeah, that makes perfect sense. If I told you that reporter worked for NPR, you'd go, oh, yeah, well, that makes perfect sense. Or NBC or ABC or CNN or any of them, you'd go, yeah, well, you know what? That makes perfect sense because they're all the same. Every single one of them is the same. And every single one of them holds you in the most vile of contempt ever. Don't believe me? I want to play a segment for you that happened on CNN last night between Don Lemon, Rick Wilson, who is supposed to be a Republican strategist, although he's been a never-Trumper from the beginning because he didn't make any money off of the Trump campaign, and Wajat Ali, I think is how you pronounce it. I don't know how you pronounce his name. I don't care. They're all CNN guys. They're all sitting around, and they're having a good laugh. This is... And the laughter that you hear is Don Lemon. The voice you're going to hear most of is Rick Wilson, who's, again, supposedly a conservative, but he's a cable news conservative. And they are mocking Trump supporters. This is what the elitist left thinks of anybody and everybody who does not hold Donald Trump in the deepest of contempt as they do. If you needed motivation to vote against these pieces of shit, you're going to get it right here.
And obviously it's false. And look, he also knows deep in his heart that Donald Trump couldn't find Ukraine on a map if you had the letter U and a picture of an actual physical crane next to it. He knows that this is, you know, an administration defined by ignorance of the world. And so that's partly him playing to their base and playing to their audience, you know, the credulous boomer rube demo that backs Donald Trump, that wants to think that Donald Trump's a smart one and they're, oh, y'all elitists are dumb.
You elitists with your geography and your maps and your spelling, even though my
math and your reading.
Yeah, you're reading, you know, your geography, knowing other countries, sipping your latte.
All those lines on the map.
Only them elitists know where Ukraine is. Sorry, I apologize.
Oh my God.
But you know what? But it was Rick's fault. I blame Rick.
Oh my God.
NPR should
Why
do.
Why not? Sorry, hold on. Wait.
Can I tell
give
you
me
what?
A second. Hold on. Sorry. That was good. Sorry. Rick, that was a good one. I needed that. Okay, so.
They hold you in absolute contempt. They hold anyone, not them, in absolute 100% burning with rage contempt. This is who they are. This is what they are. This is what passes for an intellectual discussion. This is what passes for news analysis over at CNN. You want to know why nobody watches CNN? It's because that even though they don't say it very often, they say it every time they open their mouths. They're not as blatant as they are here, but they are. It's right there under the surface every single time they talk about anybody who isn't them. They hold you, you're an idiot, you're a rube, you talk like this and you're just a moron and you're dumb and you're stupid and you don't, you fall for Donald Trump's stupidity and he's so dumb he couldn't find Ukraine on a map. If you put a picture of Ukraine on it, you're just so stupid. What's the matter with you? Why don't you bow down to your intellectual superiors and let them run roughshod over you? That's what they want. That's who they are. That's what progressives are. You can be a progressive Republican. Teddy Roosevelt was a progressive Republican. Progressive is a state of mind. Progressive is an elite who believe that they are better and smarter than everybody else, and therefore they should be ruling the world and ruling people's lives. That is CNN. If you need motivation, bookmark this, save this episode, save that segment. If you need a reason to be motivated to vote come November, go back and listen to this. Listen to that clip and remember that's what, even if you're not a big Trump fan, that's what you're voting against when you vote for Trump. That's what you're voting for when you vote against Trump. Is that really what you want? Is that who you think this country is? God, I hope not. These people are vile. They are really vile people. All right, speaking of vile people, I meant to get to this yesterday, but I just ran out of time, so I want to play it for you today. Bernie Sanders was on CBS over the weekend talking about his health care plan and his student loan plan and his this plan and his that plan for free this and free everything. And he, Nora O'Donnell, the anchor over at CBS News, asked a pretty basic question that you don't know how you're going to pay for this. It's going to cost a fortune. How do you pay for this? And Bernie has, honest to God, no concern whatsoever for any of it. He gives, you would think somebody proposing more spending and spending more money than exists on the face of the earth would have at least some sort of BS answer for how we're going to pay for it. You know, you just thought, well, we're going to raise taxes on billionaires and that'll cover it. Just something vague like that. But he doesn't even bother to try because he's so infrequently challenged and so few people whose job it is to supposedly to be to find out answers to these sorts of questions, they don't even bother asking anymore. So when it comes up in conversation, Bernie Sanders is caught, you know, pantsless when it comes to how do you pay for these wild fantasy wet dream ideas that you have. And he just basically makes a wild admission, a hilarious admission at the end here that I think is, well, it'll probably only help him in the Democratic primary, to be honest with you. Here's Bernie Sanders.
You are a self-proclaimed socialist.
Democratic, put in there, please.
Thank you. Your agenda has promised free health care for everybody, free college tuition, and to pay off people's college loans. The price tag for that is estimated to be $60 trillion over 10 years, correct?
Well, look, we have political opponents.
You don't know. You don't know how much your plan costs.
You don't know. Nobody knows. This is impossible.
You're going to propose a plan to the American people and you're not going to tell them how much it costs?
Of course I will.
Of course I will. Why not? What the hell? Who's going to hold me to account? Nora, you're going to ask me this over the weekend and I'm not going to be asked about this ever again. At least not for a long time. And he hasn't. Now, if a normal candidate gives an answer like that, how are you going to pay for this? How are you going to pay? I don't know. We'll figure it out. What the hell? You know, the government has printing presses. We'll just print it. I mean, what the hell? What's the problem? Which is exactly what happened in Venezuela. And that's what Bernie is proposing here. But who cares? Since then, Bernie has been asked about this zero times. Zero times. Nobody wants to follow up with Bernie and say, hey, you know, I couldn't help but notice that he didn't really have a good answer or even any kind of answer when it came to the idea of paying, you know, $60 trillion plus dollars and for your, all your fantasies here. Nope. He walks the halls of Congress. He walks the halls of the Senate. He's there at the impeachment trial. He can walk out to lunch. He can walk past a bank of reporters and know that he will get asked questions of, do you think John Bolton should testify? Or why do you think Republicans are so afraid to have John Bolton testify? That's more likely the tone of the questions that Bernie will take. He can walk around like a peacock, strutting around saying, what are you going to do? I propose ridiculous, wild, expensive programs that we couldn't possibly afford, and I'm just going to go skip and go get a sandwich. What are you going to do? It's unbelievable that no journalist is, the journalists should be hounding him. Journalists should be, now, if he proposed a tax cut, he's proposing $60 trillion plus in new spending. If he proposed a half a trillion dollar tax cut, which he never would, but if he did, the gaggle of reporters would not, if he were a Republican, they go, how are you going to pay for that? How are you going to pay for that? You can't afford that. You're going to blow up the deficit. How are you going to pay for that? What's going to pay? That's what they care about. But new spending, progressive government takeover, we'll just let it slide. And what's sad, what's saddest of all, is this is working. This is working. Bernie Sanders, according to some of the latest polls, they're mixed polls. Some have him second behind Joe Biden. But 1 week from yesterday is the Iowa caucuses. And the polls have Bernie Sanders at a better than average chance of winning those things. And he's out there proposing, we'll just pay for it. What does it matter? I don't know how to pay for it. We'll figure it out. Don't worry about it. If you're dating somebody who says, you know, well, I'll go buy a new Mercedes. How can you afford a new Mercedes? I don't know. We'll figure it out. I'll do it on payments or whatever. We'll figure it out. Don't worry. Don't marry them. Stop dating them. Run away from them. That is the road to bankruptcy, not the road to stability. And it sure as hell is not the road to prosperity for a presidential candidate. But for a Democrat, you can say that kind of stuff and know you're never going to be challenged. By the way, Democrats are worried that Bernie Sanders could win this thing. And that scares the hell out of them. NBC News, their headline, oh my God, Sanders can win. Democrats grapple with Bernie surge in Iowa. 4 years ago, the subheadline, 4 years ago, the Vermont senator caught the Democratic establishment sleeping in Iowa. Could he do it again? The greatest trick Bernie Sanders ever played was convincing the world the chance he could win didn't exist. Is that really the what? That's a stupid, stupid thing. But hey, that's what NBC News reports. The independent senator from Vermont has been running for president for the better part of 5 years. But some Democrats only just now, a week out from the first contest of the 2020 presidential primary season, beginning to come to grips with the fact that he could actually win the nomination. Where the hell have they been? If they're like, oh, my God, Bernie could win this. Yeah, welcome to the party, pal. You want to pull out a John McClain clip and go, welcome to the party, pal. Quote, suddenly we have the Democratic establishment very nervous about this campaign. We got Wall Street nervous, Sanders told a crowd of roughly 1,100 Sunday night in Sioux City, Iowa. They're starting to think this could really happen. We are their worst nightmare. Yeah, because even most of the Democratic establishment, while they talk a good socialist game, recognize that socialism sucks. They want to sell socialism, they want the votes, but they want socialism light because they like being rich themselves. They want their kids to get rich. They want their families to get rich. They just don't want anybody else to get rich. Next Monday's caucuses remain a toss-up, according to the polls, but Sanders has taken the lead in several recent surveys of Iowa and New Hampshire and continues to be the field's best fundraiser without having faced the same intensity of incoming fire as other candidates like fellow progressive Elizabeth Warren. It really is. See, the reason that Bernie Sanders has been able to get away with what he's been getting away with, and it's things like with the Nora O'Donnell clip there, is normally the people that would call him out are A, journalists, and journalists are on his team, so they're not going to really question him, and B, the other candidates. If the other candidates started pointing out how Bernie Sanders is talking about spending $60 to $70 trillion and has no freaking clue how to come up with that, how to pay for that, and I'm not talking about a casual mention because Joe Biden sort of alluded to it, but I'm talking about really hammering home the fact that he is talking about spending more money than exists and he has no clue how he's going to get it. And more than doubling, by the way, more than doubling the federal budget per year, and has no idea how he's going to pay for it. That if the other candidates really started hammering and making that a point to campaign on, then it would have to be covered. Then reporters would ask Bernie Sanders about it the way that they did with Elizabeth Warren. Remember Elizabeth Warren, she's proposing this, that, and the other thing, and said, are you going to raise middle-class taxes to pay for that? And she played cutesy for about 5 or 6 weeks. She wouldn't give a straight answer. Then eventually she had to give a semi-straight answer. And it, by then, she'd lost the people and she'd lost all of her momentum. If you want to go back and do an autopsy on where her campaign fell apart, that's where her campaign fell apart. That same thing could happen to Bernie Sanders to a large extent, but the Democratic candidates don't want to do that. Why don't they want to do that? Because the support for Bernie Sanders is not support really for an ideology. It's based on ideology, but it's married to Bernie. It's very personal to Bernie. I don't know if they all got daddy issues or what the deal is, but it is very personal to Bernie himself. And they're afraid that to criticize Bernie is to alienate his supporters. And that's why the rest of the field has gone so far left, although some of them are that far left. They desperately realize that in order to have a chance of winning come the fall, they need the radical Bernie bros. They need those supporters. They may not like them. They may not agree with them. They may fear them, but they desperately need them. So they can't attack their God. They can't attack their golden God. So Bernie gets a free pass. Bernie gets to say, I don't know. Yeah, I'll propose whatever. What the hell? Why not? What are the consequences? Because to criticize Bernie would be to risk losing his army of flying monkeys. They think they can beat Bernie without losing his supporters. They don't seem to realize that if you beat Bernie, you've lost his supporters. You don't beat their God and then suddenly become their God. They just hate you. And they'll vote for the Greens or something like that. But it's fun to watch. I do like the infighting on the left. That is all the time we have for today. Thank you for listening. Hopefully we'll have the final closing arguments in the opening statements from the White House, and we can get to the question and answer session on Wednesday. We shall see. We'll know more tomorrow, and I'll see you then.
And no one is above the law, not the president and not Congress.